Welcome, Dr. Thomas McCann. Dr. Thomas McCann. Now, you may have heard that name over the last few days, and that's because yesterday, Thomas achieved something that puts him alongside a small group of very impressive people. Yesterday, Thomas became one of only a handful of travellers in Ireland to be awarded a PhD, thus the doctor in his title. How does it feel? Do you feel different?
not that different now, to tell the truth. Just glad to be at the other end of it, you know, kind of to be through it and to have it done. Now, it's really nice to get it done, and it allows you then to focus on things that was in it rather than focus on a much broader kind of spread of issues, you know.
Yeah, I suppose it's the theory versus the practical, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's within an academic framework. Yes. And, you know, you have to fit in, I won't say fit in, but you have to meet the criteria in that framework.
To get the qualification.
It's really a researcher, that's what you're kind of qualifying as.
You were on Morning Ireland yesterday morning and I heard you, and we've met before.
Yeah.
We met at the screening of Patrick, A Young Traveller Lost, which is a very powerful and very sad documentary. They had you on yesterday morning, and I see a lot of people read your story on RT.ie.
Yeah.
And the thing, I suppose, that pulled them in was the fact that you left school at the age of 11.
Well, it would have been around 11, or I think more towards 12, I'd say, than 11. But yeah, I would have. But that wouldn't have been. Yeah, it probably was about 12. That wouldn't have been that unusual for within travellers. And for me, it was like, you know, kind of that was it. That was the end of my schooling, really, you know, kind of. So
what did you do then in your teenage years? Can you remember?
Worked with my father. And
so this is the 60s, 70s, 70s?
It would have been the early 70s, and would have worked with
What did your father do?
Well, he collected scrap, cleaned chimneys. He was a chimney sweep and they did everything really, you know, kind of, and then kind of anything that they would have collected out through the houses, they would have brought to the markets and that, you know, kind of at the time. And and horses as well. He would have bought and sold horses and, you know, kind of.
And there was a definite role for travellers then.
Well, you were part of, you know, the family was like, now my family, families are different. I mean, you know, kind of course, you know, I'm a traveller, but families are different and, you know, and like certainly within my family, and I don't think it was that much different for other families as well at the time. You had a role within that family that you did kind of, you know, you had to.
No, but what I was saying is, well, even like a traveller's role in the community was more defined back then because there were certain jobs they did.
There were certain jobs, was certain jobs they did. And in some ways it was defined. Now, that's not the kind of box people in.
No,
people doing other things.
Yes, I know.
Many travellers would have been like
Tinsmiths,
Tara McCadden came in the early, in the 70s as well. You know, horse dealing, scrap dealing, you know, kind of recycling, as it's called now. Which was
salvaging and
kind of so travellers were early recyclers, but we weren't known as recyclers. We were seen as rubbish, and then kind of out through the houses and that, you know, collecting stuff or doing stuff, and then it would have been sharpening as well. Some people would have gone out and sharpened lawnmowers or tools to be sharpened and stuff like that. Other people would have worked on like they call them tree doctors now, but they would have done all that.
And as you describe all those jobs, they've all become sort of organised, haven't they? Other people are doing them. Like you have the tree doctors and they have the vans and they have the hoovers and the big things and all that sort of thing.
All that's changed.
Yes, and we have recycling and all of that. So I suppose what I'm getting at is
much more regulated
as
well.
Yes, regulated. Yes, that's the word. And as a result, it sort of has deprived travellers from fulfilling those roles. That's one of the things that's happened. We're going to talk at length about other things as well.
Yeah, it has indeed. And but the thing about it as well, right, is like, you know, certain things happen that actually then impact on travellers, kind of the opportunities that travellers have as well. Like you have, of course, you had the horses legislation brought in. And on one level, you'd say it's really good that there's, you know, horses legislation. But like a lot of travellers, kind of their horses was taken and they didn't have any way of getting them back. And, you know, we've seen a documentary recently on, you know, kind of on the horses, what happens to the horses and stuff like that. And now I'm not saying that happens across the board, but, you know, a lot of travellers' horses was taken. Kind of you had the trespass legislation that doesn't allow people to travel, you know, kind of you had the markets, you know, so you needed a license for the markets. Yes. And all of that then impacts on what's called the travel economy.
Right. It's difficult to know where to start with you. I suppose we'll stick with education because that's the headline news at the moment for you, your PhD.
Yeah.
So after leaving school before secondary school, when did you get an itch that you needed to scratch when it came to re-education?
Yeah, I think really it was through becoming involved in activism.
Right.
And in the early 80s, kind of you might remember, I don't know, the Tala bypass and that and all of that. And then, you know, kind of...
People were moved on.
Yeah, not only moved on, you had a lot of vigilantes kind of, marching on travellers out in the Tala bypass, you had them blocking roads, kind of looking for proof of address to get down roads, kind of surrounding traveller cars and stuff like that. And coming very early in the morning, banging at people's places and stuff. Right. And even worse than that, but... Like, no one was being arrested for that. No one was being held accountable for any of that. And so I became involved with some of my brothers and a number of settled people and indeed other travellers such as Nan Joyce and Chrissy Ward and Peter Donahue and a few others. And we started, because they were holding a big protest out in Tal against travellers. And travellers were really frightened and there was no one really protecting travellers. There was no, you know, there was no protection for them at the time. And the guards didn't seem to be doing anything about the vigilantes, and there were vigilantes, a lot of them, you know. So we held counter protests and started getting involved in that. That was my involvement, and it was through that process that that I felt I needed a framework,
right,
for my political activism.
I wonder, were you sitting in rooms with people? Did you feel ever that other people had an advantage because they had an education?
Yeah, you feel, I think it was kind of, I've called it, like it's internalization of oppression, like that you feel less than, or you don't feel as good as, or, you know, you don't feel you know as much as, or you have to do, you know, and I've often felt that in the past, you know, kind of even in places that you think, oh God, maybe I shouldn't be here. When I did a master's in Trinity, I thought, I was walking across
But everybody has that, you know.
I think there's chapters
in books about it. Absolutely, imposter syndrome.
Absolutely.
Yes,
yeah. I think that's there. But I think when you come from a marginalised community and you've been told, you know, again and again, and you've seen that kind of expressed and you've been excluded, you internalise that feeling that you're not good enough, you're not good enough to go, even though, you know, and you struggle against that, you know. So I hear what you're saying about imposter syndrome, but it's another level to that. It's there. And I mean, I've talked to many people about it and it is there for many people, but there's even a deeper level of that.
It's that multiplied by 10.
That's there. So that certainly was something I kind of had to struggle with at times, you know, even in the PhD I wrote it in my reflexive piece about that coming up, you know, and I recognise that feeling when it comes up, you know.
Did you feel like yesterday you were conferred with a PhD?
Yeah.
Was there a sort of a vindication at the age of 64, just 65? No, was there a sense of vindication for you, or what were the emotions yesterday?
The emotions was, well, I was happy that my family was there. I was really happy because the last time I graduated in Maynooth, my father... who never went to school in his life and who couldn't write his own name, came to my graduation in 1987. And, you know, so it took me back to that, you know, kind of. And there was no other travellers in that room in 1987. There was, you know, travellers, me and my mother and father was the only ones. And then yesterday, seeing not only a large group of travellers graduating from different courses, including the youth and community work, but also from social work, and I believe there was a teacher graduated as well, that, you know, and all their families and friends. It was great to see so many travellers at the graduation, kind of as part of that kind of, and that for me, that was really, but having my own family there,
which is brilliant, because the stats are still very worrying, aren't they, education?
Yeah. They really are.
Like, and the fact that I'm here talking to you, the fact that you're a sort of an oddity in a way, getting a PhD.
One of the oddities.
Yes, there are a number of but it's less than 10.
It is a handful. And I do believe there's a man who did do a PhD.
Yes, before. So you're not the first man.
I'm not the first man.
And it's often that Morning Ireland get it wrong.
Yeah. No, and I've always said that. If you don't, you're not, and I would never claim to be the first. The first isn't important for me. No. It tells us how far we have to go. Okay. That's what it says to me.
Now, here's a big question for you. Well, I know the answer already, but it's going to get us into the next part of the interview. Are you a spokesperson for the traveller community?
I think I don't. My role in the community is not is kind of. I'm the manager of the Traveller Counselling Service.
Right.
I run a counselling service, and mental health support. That's what I do.
Okay.
But in some ways, because maybe I've been around so long and in many different things, and I'm involved in so much that kind of I'm seen as kind of maybe somebody who represents travellers. Okay. So,
but you're at the coalface because of what you do.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you are well aware then that the metrics are really poor for the travelling community. I'm just looking.
Absolutely.
When it comes to homelessness, they're at the top. Yeah. Suicide rates, the travelling community are at the top. Unemployment, travelling community at the top. Dissatisfaction with life at the top. Yeah, yeah. And all of those things have a hugely negative effect on well-being.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, I know I just finished the PhD, but actually I'm just about to start a course that Gabor Maté runs on trauma and intergenerational trauma, because, I think for travellers and indeed for others that, this intergenerational trauma of all of that stuff that impacts on us. It's like them things, we carry that and we pass it on and, and the society that we live in. So I think travellers are carrying a lot of trauma. And also the denial of culture. I mean, for decades there was a denial of traveller culture, that.
What is traveller culture?
Well, traveller culture is like any other culture. There's values and norms and language.
Okay, I'll put it this way then. This is a better question then.
Yeah.
What does it mean to you to be a traveller?
It's identity. It's about being part of. I mean, my ancestry is very important to me, Ray. My grandfathers and grandmothers and great-grandmothers and what they went through, and they were nomadic. They were all nomadic. And I want to just say something about nomadism, because I think it's misunderstood by the settled community. I think the settled community see it as a journey from A to B. Nomadism isn't a journey from A to B. Nomadism is a way of life. It's a mindset that kind of, so it's not just getting to there and that's the end of the journey, So, I think there's a difference. And, part of that came up in the thesis as
it's
well.
It's not geographical. It's a way of life. It's a lifestyle.
And extended family was part of that way of life, self-employment was part of that way of life, And there was a whole music and song and...
Because say, for example, when I was at college, I was going to do a thesis on the Irish press.
Right, okay.
Moving from set, the whatever way the printing was, to direct input.
Big
change. Yeah. And the reason I cite that is that, loads of jobs have changed over the years and a lot of them have disappeared. And what I'm saying to you is that you have to move on.
So
it's not just about jobs. It's about more than that.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think this is the kind of misunderstanding that, when you talk about traveller culture to a member of the settled community, to see it as a thing, to see it as a kind of either kind of being nomadic. So people say, are you settled? And there's no such thing as a settled traveller. You're only living in a house, because... it's part of your culture, your whole culture is what it is, And traveller is just one word. In the past, travellers was called tinkers, which was another part of the...
That was one of the trades.
Yes, one of the trades. Yeah. So there's all these parts of what the culture is, So
right. Sometimes people hide behind beliefs or cultures.
Yeah, yeah.
And just because it's part of your belief system or part of your culture doesn't necessarily mean it's a good thing. Do you see any aspects of what might be loosely termed as traveller culture that could be negative?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think, like, of course, you know, kind of culture is very broad because it takes in everything, as I say, values, norms. Yeah. And it's usually, just to explain to people, you know, it's like an iceberg, you know. What you see on the top is not all, what you don't see in the bottom is the values and the norms and the traditions and the taboos and the humour or all of that. So it's like that. But yeah, in cultures, like in every culture, there's kind of things that might prevent people from moving on or whatever.
Right. Give us a few examples.
Well, in every culture, I mean, there is, you know. I'm just thinking now, for instance, and I'm, kind of in terms of travel culture, there might be that, and there is that thing, more so within travel culture. Say, for instance, reaching out for help.
Right.
If somebody, kind of, around mental health was a huge taboo.
Now,
I mean, it was in the settled community, but more so within travellers.
So attached to a mental health problem was shame.
Shame.
Not only for the person who was suffering, but for...
for the family.
Okay.
You know, and so, that's changing.
Okay.
That has been changing. And
right, that's one thing. Okay.
Yeah.
So what about attitudes to sexuality?
Yeah. Well, there's attitudes. Well, as I said, and I mean, I'm going to ask you a question.
Right,
too. In terms of the settled community, what you see as... in terms of settled culture, what might be negative in the settled culture? So we'll.
Oh yeah, no,
that's okay. And I'm not.
There is. I think. But I think.
Yeah,
I think
sexuality. Yeah.
No, but I think just I'll answer that now because when you're in a minority.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I suppose there are more reasons to hold on desperately to what you have, and sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
True.
That might be. Not a good idea.
No, I agree.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes.
And I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
When a culture is under threat, it can become very defensive about its practices and that. And so that's a reaction to being annihilated or being rubbed
out or
whatever.
Yes, it is, of course.
Yeah.
But it can have negative effects then. You know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In terms of sexuality, can you maybe you just say what you mean by sexuality?
I suppose if you're a young traveller male.
Right, okay.
Right, and you're growing up as a gay man.
Right, okay, yeah.
How does that work out for you?
Okay, well, things, as I say, culture isn't static. I mean, you have the opportunity to change, cultures move on, and different generations kick against the last culture. Usually, that's the way. LGBT issues was really a taboo within the travel community. I think it was a taboo generally. I mean, it was illegal here.
Till 1993,
Not so long ago. Yeah. But certainly within the travel community, that was also, it was also a taboo, a huge taboo. However, in the last 20 years, that has been changing quite a lot.
Okay.
In terms of the work that travel organisations, including ourselves and others, is doing, but also the community on the ground kind of changing with that as well. Right. Now, if you look at what that change means in reality, that Travellers won the Gay Pride Award one of the years and is now very much part of that. That there's an LGBT... Now, I'm not saying it's all kind of rosy in the garden, but like that, you know, changing the things. And I think that's where kind of, where a lot of the traveller groups are looking at. What do we need? What can we promote in terms of positive change?
Yeah.
Not just with the settled community, but within the within our own community.
And it's interesting you say that because we had Helena Power in before Christmas last year, and she was talking about the conversations that need to be had within the traveller community.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Difficult ones. And I listed sexuality is one.
Yeah.
Substance misuse.
Absolutely.
Was another one.
Yeah.
And the third one, value in education, as in the value placed by the community in an education.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what Helena said, but around the value in education, I would disagree with Helena because, certainly from my family and any of the families that I know over the years, I've never met any traveller family, and I'm not just saying this, that didn't want their children educated.
Okay.
That wanted them, they had they tried desperately, and I was on the Equality Authority for 8 years as well as a board member of the Equality Authority, and I seen the cases coming through where kids wasn't allowed into the school. Yeah. I seen a case in the west of Ireland where a school was actually closed because the settled community didn't want children.
As recently as last year, there was a values lab survey done by Niall Crowley and Rachel Mullen, and they talked to a number of traveller groups and got their reaction, and the first hand testimony about people's experience in education is embarrassing for us as a country.
But if you look at now, Ray, if you look at the struggle that travellers, myself included in 1987, but kind of besides that, all the travellers who's gone back to third level education as mature students who had families who didn't have all the supports, kind of, you know, if you're coming from, as a school leaver, and went back into third level education, who graduated and came back into the community with that. If you look at that, people like Michael McDonough, Maria Joyce, there's a whole range of people. And you look at that struggle.
Hugely positive.
It just tells you that there's a real value.
And on top of that, and this is the other thing that's come up in research over and over again, it's role models.
Yeah.
You know, that members of the traveller community need to see people like themselves getting PhDs, going to university. Yes.
Yeah. You need to see yourself or your own community reflected in whatever it is, whether it's in services or whether it's in academia or whatever. That way there's a relationship developed if you see your community reflected.
This is a positive chat, Thomas. Yeah, but I just wonder, because you've been around for a long time. Looking back, and you've been involved in activism, looking back, has the traveller community made mistakes in their relationship with the settled community? There's no doubt that the settled community have made mistakes. And there's been institutional mistakes. Like, we go back to 1963, where the government put out a report to say, let's assimilate travellers into the settled community.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Go on.
I'm not here to defend the whole traveller community.
No, but I know.
Of course, I'm sure.
You've heard all the criticism.
Yeah. The difference is, right, is this. I'm sure kind of there's been kind of, you know, mistakes by families, with traveller families and the settled community. But I can't say, the difference is that it's the institution in terms of the state that was responsible for a lot of the stuff. And that's the difference. It wasn't the settled population per se. It was the state that actually kind of, you know, whereas of course there was incidents of, you know, whether it was in Tala, as I was saying, about vigilantes marching on travellers or whatever, you know, of course you had them. And I'm sure you had travellers who, you know, wronged settled people along the way, because we're a big community, you know, kind of a large community. So, but in terms of the difference in that is that the state actually institutionalised a lot of that, and
this is hard for people to understand, but like, if you are suffering racism and if there is prejudice that prevents you from going into education, then you don't get the same opportunities as everybody else, and sometimes then that might lead you down a road of crime.
Of course,
because there are more there. The travelling community is disproportionately represented in our prisons.
Absolutely, and I mean, and that's not unique to travellers, just to say that. I mean, I think, you know...
Well, if you look at the black community in America or...
But if you look at, like, I mean, besides ethnic demographic, if you look at the poverty demographic and you look at the prisons, you look at, like, about 70%, 80% of prison population comes from disadvantaged settled community. Yes. And that's driving a lot of the crime. But in terms of travellers, there was a study carried out recently, in terms of Cindy Joyce and others.
Another PhD.
Yeah, absolutely. Great woman. Yeah. In terms of the criminal justice system. And it shows that, like, we need, like, that prejudice that we've talked about there is also represented in the judicial system, in the legal system, and in the guards, and in the prison system. So where you have that, you know, kind of, like, in the
past... An institutional racism.
Absolutely. Yes. And, like, if you were a traveller... now, hopefully it's changing a bit, as I said, things move
on
and
change.
But it's slow. It is slow. But if you were a traveller and you were up for whatever charge you were up on, and you were living in an unofficial site, you didn't have an official dress. So more than likely, guilty or not, you would be put on remand. Yeah.
Right.
Because you didn't have an official address. Uh-huh. And so you see how these things work themselves out.
And then once you're in the system, then.
And yeah, absolutely. But yeah. but there's loads of instances. I'm not saying that there's no guilty. Of course, people commit crime, yes, and you know, yeah. and need to be punished for the crime. But also then, in terms of, like, a traveller woman is 22 times more likely to go to prison than a settled woman. Now, if you look at the crimes and you look at the sentencing, you see that there's a disparity in terms of the what people yeah. get larger sentences for, you know.
Are you hopeful?
Of course I am. Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course I'm very hopeful. I don't know, we were having a positive chat about
it. No, we are. It is a positive. You know? It is a because I think, no. I tell you why it's positive.
I
tell you why it's positive, Thomas, and yeah. this is important. Yeah. Because people have to hear these sort of chats.
Absolutely.
Because too often the chats around the travelling community are negative and they're not represented.
Well, that's very interesting, Ray, you say that, because Eileen Flynn, Senator Eileen Flynn, she's great, another great woman, and she mentioned it a few times. She says, you come in to talk about traveller culture, but what you end up talking about is the issues.
Yes.
You know, so like, you know, that's what gets confused, the issues and traveller culture. You know, these two things, you know, kind of that, you know. So,
well, in my mind, they're sort of inextricable in some, are they not?
No, I mean, we don't talk about music. We don't talk about storytelling.
We have talked about that.
I'm not saying you don't. But she was.
I suppose your area of expertise, though, is activism and mental health.
Yes, absolutely.
So unless
you can see how down things can get.
I completely understand that.
And I'm not saying here, but that's not just for settled people, but for travellers as well. They might go in somewhere to talk about traveller culture, and they end up talking about the issues.
I'm sorry if this has gone away that you didn't want to
talk. Don't be.
But I think these chats are hugely important.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You know, they're hugely important, and we don't hear enough of them.
I think you're right. I think we need more dialogue and spaces for that dialogue.
Exactly, and not a sort of a 5-minute thing shoved to one side and
absolutely. And I think it's looking at, well, how do we bring about change?
Yes.
How do we move together collectively, traveller and settled, and whoever else is, because we are a very multicultural island, and that's going to happen more so, and we can see what happens when the seeds of kind of racism is embedded in kind
of. How do you feel about that?
I feel very strongly about it, because I saw them things happening to travellers. I saw travellers' houses getting burned, around the country. There's many incidents where travellers' houses that was kind of going to be given to traveller families were burned before.
This is in the past.
In the past.
So you're seeing a repeat of this now.
I've seen a repeat of it. I've seen the marches in the past. I've seen people being intimidated and attacked and, you know, kind of, and like, you know, so it's like a replay of that in some ways. And it's dangerous, you know, because it's divisive, it's not helpful, and it doesn't help change the situation either for the people who's there, the refugees and asylum seekers who's fleeing. It's all they want is a safer, better life, you know, kind of for themselves. That's all they want, you know. And like, I mean, to give people a chance to, you know, to contribute.
And we need to be reminded as well, like, we went here, there and everywhere. For hundreds of years.
We're all, Irish people are all over the world.
All over the world.
Imagine if, we were.
To get a PhD in your 60s, some achievement, and to do so with all the obstacles and the prevailing attitudes to minority in this country makes that PhD a great achievement. I salute you, sir. I get emotional when I read these now. Congratulations to your guests. As was told to me at my graduation, I wish to say to him, welcome to the community of scholars, Vincent.
But I think you're right, Ray. I think, you know, kind of, it's true that, you know, hopefully through that understanding and dialogue that we begin to change. But we need concrete changes as well to give people the opportunity to progress, whether it's asylum seekers and refugees.
Here's two things that came out of that values lab thing. So sort of not calls for, but suggestions of an ombudsman for travellers.
An ombudsman for travellers. We've talked about this one of the reasons that came up is that there's so many different areas. You're after naming a lot of them there, accommodation, education.
We didn't mention accommodation, but then
across the board.
Yes.
That you need an independent ombudsman.
Would that person be a traveller?
Ah, no, I don't think so. I think they'd need an independent office.
Okay, well, that makes sense to me.
But one of the reasons that came up is that we look at the changes, the attitudes, the change in attitudes, but also the structures towards due to a children's ombudsman. And you see that
the changes that have happened as a result.
It has made a huge
difference
in society in general. And that's where that thinking came from.
State apology.
State apology. I think a state apology is very important. I think, you know, kind of now, I think that's part of a bigger process, you know, kind of where you have some kind of a reconciliation process, you know.
But it's interesting because back in 1963, if the settled community were looking at what the government wanted to do, as in assimilate travellers into the settled way of life, they're going, well, there must be something wrong with those people. They're othered because the state wants to change them. So I would think that a state apology for how the travelling community has been treated by the state over the years would be a very positive thing.
It would.
It would make people in general perceive the travelling community in a more positive light.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're dead right. I think but also in terms of for all the suffering that the traveller community went through because of the state's stance on travellers, because like, you know, the state as Charlie Haughey said, in the opening, kind of in his opening statement to the Commission on Itinerancy, there can be no final solution to the problem of itinerancy until they're all absorbed into the settled community. Yeah. That was a kind of an indication to all the service, all the arms of the state that, look, you know, to eradicate travel culture, really, you know, kind of. And so I think that suffering, the mental health crisis that we have now, is due to a lot of that. I mean, when people, the shame we talked about.
Yeah, yeah.
In schools, like, travellers were kind of punished and made to feel ashamed if they acted like a traveller or talked like a traveller, kind of, you know, and I was rewarded if they kind of, so you can see.
Yes, that assimilation was rewarded.
That was embedded.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think a state apology would be very good in terms of, you know, for the community.
Well, we've only scratched the surface there.
Yeah, we have, yeah. And
Dr. Thomas McCann, congratulations once again on your PhD, and enjoyed the free travel.
Yeah.
Which is a nice way of saying happy 65th birthday.
Well, listen, thanks very much, Ray.
But isn't that, I really appreciate it. Because you're so healthy and all that. And
well, I hope so. I mean, you know, my knees are beginning to But yeah, thanks very much.
Anyway, Joan Kildare says, I'm really enjoying the informative and in-depth warts and all discussion about the traveller community and related issues. Your guest is so intelligent, objective, honest, loyal and inspirational. Joan Kildare. So
thanks very much.
Final word to Joe. Thanks, Thomas. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Stephanie Rainey. Now, we've been crossing our fingers and our toes for Stephanie. She had an anxious 24-hour wait to see if she got past the live quarter-final round of America's Got Talent. It's the biggest summer entertainment show in the States, over 10 million viewers. She gave an emotional performance of her song Woman alongside her best in front of 5 million people, it says here, but maybe it's 10 million for the final. But Stephanie, commiserations.
Hello, Ray. thanks very much.
Yeah.
We're feeling good. I'm not going to lie. We're totally at peace with everything. We had such a blast, and we're just ready to kind of do the next thing, you know.
Yeah. So you performed, and what the judges gave their opinions, and then you had to wait 24 hours to get the result of the public vote. Was that it?
Yeah, so the lines are kind of only open for, I think it's actually quite a short window, really. It's only for a couple of hours after the show. So you perform on, like, we performed on Tuesday night over here. Well, Tuesday evening over here, like between kind of 5 and 7. And then the following day at 5 o'clock is when the results show is. So it's a pretty tight turnaround. We kind of knew going into it with more original music. Original music is tough on a show like this. It would probably have been easier for us if we'd done a cover or something like that. But that's not the act that we were, you know. We went in there with original songs and it was important to carry that forward. And, you know, we're happy with what we chose to do.
Yeah.
It was always going to be tough to try and follow up Please Don't Go. But there was nothing else that we would have actually done on the day.
So just to let our listeners know, Please Don't Go is a song you wrote about your nephew, Fionn, who died just before he celebrated his first birthday. And that's the one you did in the auditions. And it obviously struck a chord, as you would expect. And
yeah,
then
for sure.
The other night then you sang Woman, which was a song written about your mother.
Yes, correct. Yeah. So I wrote Woman about my mom when she was very, very sick in 2019. Into 2020, kind of recovering from a cancer diagnosis, a pretty serious one. And, you know, with that, we nearly lost my mom a couple of times throughout that year from varying different things. And it was just about, that Woman is about like any person that you have really, like that has impacted your life and taught you about yourself and sacrificed for you and all of those things that we get from strong women in our lives. And it's when we play live, it's a song that people connect to in a huge, huge way. And you know, like the other night we got mixed feedback about the song. Actually on the night it felt like we got worse feedback, and then when I watched it back, actually they were all like, yeah, I really liked it, but we loved Please Don't Go a little bit like the takeaway.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know what I mean? You can't try and reverse engineer that when we left,
like you were being compared to yourself.
And I think, you know, some of the feedback was Sophia and Heidi really, really loved it. Obviously maybe they connected to it a little bit more. Howie was just saying that he liked the audition a bit more, and Simon was like I actually really think you did well, but he's like, I love Please Don't Go, and he recommended that if you know, he thought we would move on, and he said, you know, I think you should do Please Don't Go again. But that would have felt strange to me, you know, because I felt at that stage then that we would be chasing our tail trying to figure out what the right thing to do would be.
Yeah.
To try and let
I think listening to you now, that you sound very sanguine, and you feel that you were true to yourself, and that's hugely important, that you won't be looking back and saying, what if this and what if that? You decided on a way, and you're happy with that, which is great. I'm just wondering about the scale. So where is it shot?
So it's shot in Pasadena in Pasadena Civic Auditorium. So it's kind of like an opera house, but maybe slightly bigger. And then everything's in Pasadena. So the hotel is kind of connected to the venue and you kind of rehearse in that space as well. And it's, you know, it's all kept very in-house and it's run like so amazingly well. It's unbelievable. So, you know, we've had such an amazing, we had such an incredible week over here.
Yeah.
And we, of course, would have loved another crack at another performance.
But you got to the quarterfinals. Like, that's huge, isn't it? It's a huge achievement. Huge achievement.
Yeah. I mean, it's down from like literally tens of thousands of people to 44. Yeah, yeah, so, you know, we have to be happy.
And I know
with
you've
that.
Done live stuff here before, but was the lead up to going live to America, what was that like?
It was nerve-wracking, man. You know, it was definitely nerve-wracking. I think, like, you know, when the light goes on, you definitely feel those nerves a teeny bit more. And obviously, you know as well that there's, like, four of the biggest celebrities in the world kind of sitting in front of you, just looking up at you all of a sudden. So it is definitely nerve-wracking, you know. I definitely felt like I performed it slightly better in the rehearsals. So that would have, but also, I was actually quite happy with the performance in the end, you know. I think that it's always going to kick into you to have a little bit of nerves, but we're really proud of it. And actually, like, the reaction to it online has been unbelievable. Like, you know, people understand, you know, just I've gotten so many messages. Like, I just read one before I came on here that just brought an absolute tear to my eye. It was just like a woman sent a comment under the YouTube video just saying, you know, I'm a breast cancer survivor and I feel like you wrote this song for me.
Right. Yeah.
So like you see things like that and then you kind of go, you have to look at the bigger picture. You have to look at the impact you're having. And for me as an artist, you know this, like it's always about connection for me. It's always about trying to find the source of the person. And that's what we have to carry with us.
And getting your work, your art, for want of a better word, out to a bigger audience. Because we're a tiny little country, Stephanie, here, you know. I think it's increasingly difficult for artists to break through. And although music has become democratized and, you know, everybody can put something up on Spotify, it's actually proven more difficult, I think, isn't it?
It has, you know, and I think that's why we felt we wanted to do something like a little jolt out of the norm for us, to try and you know, move things along. It's certainly hard, you know, like I've experienced my music resonating like all over the world for a long time now, but particularly in the last year. And that's why we were like, okay, how do we get this from like just being on a TikTok thing or an Instagram thing or a YouTube thing to being a thing where people discover you as an artist? And America's Got Talent was absolutely it. And what we're very, very fortunate for is our audition tape was one of the highest performing audition tapes of the entire series. And they're kind of the things
They're the metrics.
They perform better.
Yes, yeah.
They are the metrics, yeah. The live shows never perform as well as the auditions.
Yes. And the other thing is, we were talking about X Factor early on because it's 20 years since X Factor began in the UK. And of course, the most successful act in X Factor UK history didn't win it. In fact, it came third, and I'm talking about One Direction, of course. What happens? So there were two of you there, and then the result is announced. What was that? What happened in your head there? What did you do? What was going on?
I think like the results show definitely was a nerve-wracking experience, just because like you kind of wait all day for it. You kind of rehearse the results, like not the actual results, but you kind of rehearse the how the format is.
Yeah, go over there. You have to go over there if you lose. You go over there if you win, blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Which makes sense because obviously, and it is good because, you know, otherwise you're just flailing around the stage. It was nerve-wracking for sure. I think I kind of had an inkling that we might make it, you know. I think I kind of had that feeling the night before. But I was also kind of at peace with it because I was like, I didn't really want to get into the territory of trying to figure out what the right thing to do was.
Yeah.
We came with Woman and we were like, that's what we want to do. Mm. And I felt like the next week we would be like, okay, what's similar to Please Don't Go, but different. But, you know.
Well, 100 Like Me, like I played it there, still sounds amazing.
I know. Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. And we've got plans for some of the songs like that. We've got plans to, you know, there's so much. Okay. There's so much happening off the back of this.
Okay, well, that's my next question. So you've preempted it. What's next?
What's next is, I mean, we obviously have our Vicar Street show as soon as we kind of get back. That's the first thing in, you know, in the immediate future. Yeah. I have an EP coming out on the 14th of November to coincide with that. So it's called The Highs and Lows of It All. Right. We announced that yesterday, which is a perfectly apt thing.
Yeah.
And then Vicar Street. And actually, just because this is something that just got flagged to me just before we came on. If you want to come to see us in Vicar Street, the best way to try and get tickets for that at the moment is through my website at stephanierainey.com, because there seems to be an issue with one or two of the links that's floating around.
Right.
So if you're looking for Vicar Street tickets, go to my website to try and get them. So it's Vicar Street, it's City Hall, but there's a lot of things happening around now. That will kind of, I think, come to fruition in the next couple
interesting.
Of months.
All exciting and all positive, I hope.
All exciting, all positive. Great. We're so proud of what we've done. We're so proud of having had the opportunity to be here. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Really, I can. And also, just the level of support that we've had from home has been just immense. Like, just shows me, like, Irish people just show up for you. They just show up for you. Hundreds of messages, thousands of messages from home, from people abroad that are living here. We're so grateful. We are so, so grateful. I cannot express it to you enough. And I am so grateful to Sarah, who came over and did this with me. She put herself in the absolute firing line. It's chaos. Like, it is not. Now, like, the whole week, we're like, what are we doing here? It's crazy.
You could start a trend, Stephanie Rainey. Would you recommend this to other people?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
You know? It's not easy. It's not easy. And, you know, you have to be willing to be opening yourself up to judging and criticism.
All of that. Yes.
But absolutely, it's worth it.
You wouldn't change a thing. You wouldn't change a thing. Well, listen, congratulations again. Quarter finalist in America's Got Talent, Stephanie Rainey. And you get tickets for the upcoming gigs at stephanierainey.com. Go back to sleep there, Stephanie Rainey, in Los Angeles. Good luck. See you. Bye. Bye.
Bye.